Chapter 37. The Constitution. On 14 February 1995, President Nelson Mandela unveiled the Constitutional Court's plaque, emblazoned with an appropriately inspiring logo. Just as Albie Sachs had taken on the task of coming up with the logo and had spoken to other judges who didn't want the cliched scales of justice or Roman columns, they wanted something that located the court's home in Africa and the Constitution's historical roots in the struggle for human rights. They wanted a logo that reflected the spirit of South Africa's shining new democracy and a constitution praised by jurists as one of the most progressive in the world. The judges decided the logo should be a big tree. A tree, they reckoned, is a symbol of strength, stability, and protection, just like the Constitution. Besides, justice in traditional African societies is administered under a tree, where people meet to resolve disputes, debate, and decide on the issues brought to them. And that's how the Constitutional Court's logo of a big tree sheltering people under its branches came to be. Chapter 2 of the Constitution contains the Bill of Rights, a human rights charter that protects civil, political, and socio-economic rights. It enshrines the rights of all people in the country and affirms the democratic values of human dignity, equality, and freedom. It also cherishes positive liberties that give people the ability to fulfill their potential, such as the rights to education, housing, health, and, of course, life. Yet, for the people living on the streets, the people who use bucket toilets, the parents of children who have died in pit latrines, the people who have burnt to death in condemned buildings, the millions of people who don't have jobs, the children who can't get to school, or the citizens who are assaulted by blue light brigade bullies, the Constitution is not worth the paper it's written on. Just ask Mrs. Grootboom. Oh wait, you can't. Irene Grootboom is another big tree in the story of the Constitution. This mighty oak fought to protect her community so they could enjoy the fruits of the Constitution, and in so doing she became a symbol of hope for the poor, the homeless, and the marginalized. Mrs. Grootboom was born in 1969 and lived with her family and neighbors in a shack settlement on the northeastern edge of Cape Town. They had little access to water, sewerage, or electricity, but it was their home, and throughout the 1980s, the community resisted eviction by the landowners. In the early 1990s, with the help of the Legal Resources Center, the residents obtained the right to settle on the land. They named it Wallerstein in honor of their lawyer, Wallace Mgoqi. They had the right to live there, but the land was waterlogged and the conditions were grim. Mrs. Grootboom lived with her family and her sister's family in a 20-square-meter shack. The residents applied for government housing and were put on a list. They waited and waited and waited. In 1998, after 7 years of waiting, the Gatfol community left Wallerstein and built shacks on land earmarked for low-cost housing. The municipality responded with an eviction order, and in a throwback to apartheid-style evictions, bulldozers arrived on 19 May 1999, flattened the residents' homes, and destroyed their possessions. It was the beginning of the cold, windy, wet Cape winter. The residents decamped to the Wallerstein sports field and lived under plastic sheeting until the rain destroyed their shelters. "Where must we go now?" wondered Mrs. Grootboom. The answer, she realized, was to court. So on behalf of 510 children and 390 adults, Mrs. Grootboom lodged an urgent application with the Western Cape High Court to compel the local, provincial, and national governments to fulfill their constitutional obligations and provide them with adequate basic shelter until they obtained permanent accommodation. The application was successful, but the government appealed to the Constitutional Court, where advocate Jeff Budlander, SC, a towering figure in the legal profession, was one of the lawyers representing the Human Rights Commission on behalf of the residents. He remembers a turning point in the case, which occurred in the first few minutes of argument. Jeremy Gauntlet, appearing for the government, started raising complicated questions about which spheres of government were responsible for which activities. And Chief Justice Arthur Chaskelson interrupted him and said, "Mr. Gauntlet, leaving aside all of that, where does the government say these people should sleep tonight?" There was this deafening silence because there was no answer to that question. It was a devastating question. It was unanswerable. The government settled and agreed to give the residents security on a piece of land and provide them with shelter and basic services. Despite the settlement, the court decided to continue hearing the arguments because it was itching to deal with the fundamental question about the government's obligations to socioeconomic rights. It ruled that the government was compelled to act. It was praised as a landmark judgment that not only slammed the brakes on evictions, but marked the first time that a court in any country had enforced the constitutionality of a socioeconomic right. 8 years later, in 2008, the big tree was felled. Mrs. Grootboom died in a shack, penniless. She was just 48. Days before her death, she told Cape Town journalist Francis Hueshe she was proud of the judgment, but also frustrated. "I was supposed to get a house a while back, but I'm still in a shack, which I share with my sister-in-law and her three children. They keep promising us. When it rains, water seeps through every crevice and the thing is submerged in water. I tried to repair it, but I can't do much." While the Grootboom judgment was a powerful precedent that helped communities under threat of eviction, Mrs. Grootboom became a symbol of social and economic rights not being fulfilled. And in a way, the community's constitutional court victory was also its downfall. Mrs. Grootboom and her neighbors got something modest from the court case, but they had asked for something modest. In their temporary shelters, they resumed their wait on the government's housing list for permanent homes. The government's housing program prioritizes those who are most in need, and since the Grootboom residents had been given emergency temporary housing, a place to live without the threat of being evicted and basic shelter and facilities, they fell to the bottom of the permanent housing list. So many more people were in a much worse position, and the government's obligation was to deal with them. It was, says Budlander, a deeply ironic outcome. So I ask Budlander, is the Constitution a lie? He shakes his head. No, it would be unfortunate to perpetuate the narrative that the Constitution has lied. The lie is on the part of those in the government who said, yes, we are going to comply with the Constitution, and they haven't. If you say the Constitution is a lie, it supports the narrative that the problem in our country is the Constitution, and the Constitution is to be held accountable. It's not the Constitution. It's the failure to give effect to the Constitution, the failure to implement the Constitution. That's the lie. The reasons the government is failing in its constitutional duty are obvious: the triple combination of corruption, the hollowing out of the state, and incompetence. When the Constitution took effect in February 1997, it promised a new society built on socioeconomic rights. That promise is a lie. Not because the Constitution is no good, it's the envy of human rights lawyers all over the world, but because it has been betrayed by an indifferent, inattentive, intransigent, and increasingly incompetent government.